ever used a system so outdated it crashes just when you need it? Colonial Code, hardwired in modern India. From obsession with English language to dusty laws of the 1800s, the empire left more than just memories.
Thank you.
Lingering shadows, echoes of a past. He is here to help clear the colonial fog, the hangover, once and for all.
Hi, Mr. Tajur.
How are you? Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
All good?
Very good. I'm not going to ask you if you slept well.
Don't.
Author, historian, statesman, Dr. Shashi Tharoor, welcome. So today's episode is called The Hangover, and it's not the movie.
No.
So we'll get straight into it. Now, Bhavesh Agarwal, who is the CEO of Ola Cabs, he says that India creates 20% of the world's digital data. Now, only 10% stays here. The rest of it, it goes outside, gets processed, gets converted into AI, and then it's sold back to India. Now, this sounds, Shashi, something like what the East India Company did to India's cotton. Do you think we're in the middle of digital colonialism 2.0?
It's an interesting way of looking at it. I mean, colonialism, as you know, was imposed by the force of arms. Today's approaches, and certainly what you've just called digital colonialism, is more about voluntary compliance as well. It's like all of us get these wretched consent things, right? There's a whole long list of legally impenetrable things that we are surrendering when we use a website or get onto a server or use a Wi-Fi or whatever. And automatically, most of us don't read them. We just click I accept so we can have access to what we want, right? Now, is that voluntary? Is that a form of insidious colonialism? Difficult to say, but we all are participating in that structure. Secondly, data is generated by people, but the systems that use, process, and circulate that data are generated, created, established in the developed countries, and particularly in the United States. Of course, now it's a little more widespread than just the US, but the internet was invented in the US, right? So let's start out with the fact that they had that first mover advantage and they created a genuinely beneficial system. We all value the internet. Look, I remember when I was a student abroad and calling my parents cost me an arm and a leg. I had to skip a meal if I wanted to speak to my parents. And today you can call around the world for free thanks to the internet. You can be in instant contact with people across the world. There are lots of, so there are obvious advantages. And because of those advantages, we're all complicit in the system. Now, I think there are ways in which we can address data colonialism, which we have not fully done. One certainly would be to not just generate more data here, but keep it here. But at the same time, we can't do that in a way that if we start putting up protectionist barriers, that other countries might do it to us too. We need access to data they generate. And a lot of data, a lot of knowledge comes from the developed world. We can't be denied access to that. And therefore, the deal is we can't deny them access to our data. We've got to figure out a way in which there is some mutuality. In the colonial era, the British told us what they are prepared to pay for our textiles, how much tariffs they would charge on our textiles if sent to their country, and what is more, we're able to impose the sale of their textiles in our country without any tariffs. We've talked about this. That is a completely unequal terms of trade. Today, in the sovereign world, we ought to slightly be able to equalize it.
The internet seems to believe that colonialism never really died. It just got a tech upgrade. So unfair trade, exploitative data practices, global financial systems. Is colonialism then just here, but with a better branding, say?
Well, that's again one way of looking at it. Look, no one has ever claimed that in the history of the world there was genuine equality anywhere, right? There were always some countries that were richer than others, some countries that were more powerful than others, some countries that stole a march on certain technologies. I mean, think, for example, that the leading naval power in, say, the 1400s was Portugal. Tiny country today, relatively, I mean, I say this great respect and fondness for Portugal, relatively unimportant country, even in the European scheme of things. But just 600 years ago, they conquered the seas. They had the biggest fleets, the ships, they were going all over the place. Now, that changed. So we can say in India 2,000 years ago, we were the United States of America in the world because we were the richest country. We had the largest export trade in the world. In fact, some estimates say that 50% of all the exports of goods came from India. But the fact is, that's 2,000 years ago. We can't keep living on borrowed glory. Things go up and down. There's a wonderful study by the British econometric historian Angus Maddison, which traces global GDPs going back to the time of Christ and tracing ups and downs throughout history. And that's given us some very useful data sets. But it shows that nobody has been on top permanently and nobody has been at the bottom permanently. Everyone's had their ups and downs. And I think let's first of all accept that nothing is permanent. What you and I are talking about is a reality of today, which may be different in 30 years' time, 50 years' time. As far as technology, financial structures, and so on are concerned, there is no doubt that the West, or the North, if you want to prefer the North-South divide as a term, has the dominance. Partially because these structures were established by them. For example, the entire global financial architecture was created at the end of the Second World War through the so-called Bretton Woods Conference. The World Bank, the IMF, the way in which the world works was done there. And one of the things they did, for example, was the US, which was then by far the richest country in the world, I think probably about 50% of global GDP at the end of the Second World War, they decided in a spirit of both altruism and selfishness to create the Marshall Plan to rebuild the economies of the Western world, not of anybody else. So Western Europe got rebuilt from the destruction and ashes of World War II and became full-fledged participants in the global financial system. As recently as 10 years ago, Belgium's voting rights in the World Bank and IMF were higher than China's. So that is a reflection of who created the system, right? When it comes to digital, as we talked about earlier, they invented it. So obviously they set the terms. This is not necessarily going to be set in stone forever. We are seeing changes in technology. I remember when I was studying in graduate school in the States, the contempt that used to be expressed by American professors for China. Oh, they can't even make a car. They can't even make a plane. They don't know how to do that. They're getting everything from the Russians. I'm talking of the 1970s. Today, China has startled the world by the way in which its technology, maybe it was one day at one point derived from copying the West, today has far outstripped them. For example, their e-vehicles have got a worldwide reputation. We're now hearing about the sophistication of their digital technologies. The AI program they invented is cheaper, faster, more effective than the existing competitors in the West. Now, if China can do that, tomorrow India can do it too. And I believe that we have the talent, the brains, and others to work on this. So the only difference between the colonialism that you and I have been talking about in the historical sense and the sort of neo-colonialism of today is that things are much more reversible through our own capacities, even where the structures created may represent a certain built-in inequality.
Now, Mr. Tharoor, India has been for years renaming cities. So Calcutta became Kolkata, Madras became Chennai. But just by changing some signboards, can India really move away from its past?
Well, actually, this is something which I had opposed at the time. I remember writing a very angry article in the 90s when Bombay, Calcutta and Madras became Mumbai, Kolkata and Chennai. Not because I had any particular attachment to the colonial era, but because I said we're missing out on this entire 20th century concept of branding. These are brands that have some value, that have been built up over centuries. You're destroying the brand value. Everyone, Madras was attached to a very popular fabric called Bleeding Madras. The name was in various people's minds for various products ranging from curry to clothing. Calcutta had a certain resonance. There was even a play that had nothing to do with Calcutta called Oh Calcutta that was a big success in the West End. Bombay again, you know, there's so many things from Bombay Duck to Bombay Tea to Bombay, everything else. I mean, these were brands that had some value. I said, why are you jettisoning it? And I sort of rather irritatedly said, those who cannot create have arrogated to themselves the power to rename, which was perhaps unduly nasty. I'll tell you why I was perhaps being a bit unfair is there is a certain legitimate desire to reclaim our names that were changed only because the British couldn't pronounce them. And the feeling was, why should we go along with what they have done to our nomenclature? I'll give you a couple of examples. And here is where you have to juggle between pride, cultural authenticity, and practicality. So on the one hand, you've got things like a place is called Pune. For some reason, the British call it Pune. Now, do we have to say Pune when everyone knows it's Pune? What's so difficult about saying Pune, right? Kanpur. They would say Kanpur, and they spelt it that way too. Now, why should you say Kanpur if the name is Kanpur? I just say, so let's balance our own pride with some practical considerations also. But the truth is, it has a certain appeal. And, you know, I must admit that sometimes we rename cities for good reasons. I would say when Port Blair was renamed Srivijayapura, many people said, why is everyone knows Port Blair? What is the Srivijayapura, etc.? I mean, the thing is, who was Blair? Was it somebody who mattered? What is his colonial legacy? He was apparently the first young British surveyor who surveyed that area of the Andamans. Right. Do we need to recall his name in the name of a city? I mean, if necessary, you can have a plaque somewhere saying the first survey was done by Captain whatever, Archibald Blair or whatever. But to call the entire place, I don't see any harm in going back to an ancient name, which was, in fact, a name that was used in that region by the kings of that era, and call it Srivijayapura. That's easy for Indians to pronounce, and it's part of our history. So I don't object to that. Madras and Chennai, you can quarrel about, because the funny thing is that there is a tradition around the world, if you just go larger than India, where in different languages, the same place can have different names. The Germans call their country Deutschland. In English, we call it Germany. In French, they call it Allemagne. Each country has a different name for the country. The Germans are not going around saying, we object. You have to say Deutschland in English. Why can't we have had a situation where when speaking English, you say Madras, and speaking Tamil, you say Chennai? What is the problem? To my mind, there is a certain sort of inferiority complex implicit in insisting that my language and my name and my system must be something everybody else uses.
One name that has the internet go bonkers is Bharat. Asashi, where do you stand there?
That's where I absolutely insist. When I speak in Hindi or Malayalam, I say Bharat. And when I speak in English, I say India. Not just because of the branding, but because I believe it makes no sense to attempt to say Bharat in English. Have you seen a Westerner pronounce Bharat, by the way? It comes out as Bharat. I mean, it's absurd. It almost insults my country to have it being called Bharat. I would rather it be called India, which is a name that has been around for more than 2,000 years. How did India come about? It comes about from the same way the word Hindu came about. So the very people who are proud of being Hindu and are ashamed of being Indian should ask, get their heads examined. Where is the root? The blessed Persians couldn't pronounce the letter S. So the river Sindhu, right, was the big barrier that many conquerors and migrants and so on found a challenge to cross. So the people east of the Sindhu, they called the Hindus because they couldn't say the S. So it became the Indu and became. The Greeks got the name from the Persians. Because the Greeks and the Persians, of course, remember Alexander, Macedonia coming all that way, etc. Those guys started saying Indus, because the Greek-Roman endings of US at the end of things, they took the Ind and they made it Indus. So in English, it became Indus. Everything east of the Indus became India. Now, for 2,000 years, in all the Western languages, Western maps, Western writings, India was this fabled land of riches, of glory, of culture, a desirable place to go to. It became such a wonderful concept that in the Arabic language, Hind is actually a word associated with beauty. There are girls even today named Hind to convey that they are going to be beautiful. Babies are called Hind. That was the association that India and Hind conveyed. Now, why would I sit around today and in the interests of my nationalist authenticity, throw away the value of a 2,000-year-old name with wonderfully positive associations? It's not as if it had anything negative. India was considered a wonderful place, a place of glory, of riches, of prosperity, and of beauty. Why would I throw that away in order to serve myself? When I speak in my own language, it happens to be the name of my country in my language. Like the way the Germans say Deutschland when they speak German. I will say Bharat. But when I'm speaking in English, I don't want to give up all the benefits I get from the hearer's ears and his or her mind by saying India.
Now, Dadabhai Nauroji, he argued that British Indian civil service, it drained India's wealth by excluding Indians. And since the empire was responsible for shaping some of these systems, how much of the colonial legacy do you think still affects us, Ashashi?
Well, first of all, on the British Indian Civil Service, I think it was Nehruji who said it's neither Indian nor civil nor a service. If he didn't say it, I wish he had, because I certainly agree with him completely on that. It reminded me of that famous crack about the Holy Roman Empire, neither holy nor Roman nor the empire. That's exactly what it was. It was really not Indian. They kept Indians out right till 1868, and even then very grudgingly admitted very few. It wasn't civil. It was deeply uncivil, arrogant, tyrannical in their rule, distant from the people, and really oppressive in their conduct. And they were not a service. Their job was not to serve. Their job was to extract and exploit. So what they would do, for example, the district magistrate, as we would call them today, were called collectors. Why? Because their job was to collect as much as they could of revenue and other resources from the places they controlled. That's what the service was all about. They were grossly overpaid by Indian tax money. Indian revenues paid their salaries, their extravagant home leaves every year, their absences, and their very early retirements and pensions. Just 20 years of service, you could retire to a very comfortable estate in England, earning money that the Indian taxpayer was paying. I have written about this in detail, so you can get some of the details from my book, Inglorious Empire. But I can tell you that the injustice of the system was apparent even to some of the British as early as the first half of the 19th century. They were talking about how unjust it was. But when Queen Victoria became Empress of India and issued her famous proclamation in which she said they were going to govern India for the benefit of the Indians, they actually declared that Indians could join the Indian Civil Service, and they threw open the examinations for Indians. What was interesting was, number one, very few Indians were allowed to get in because there was also an interview. Oh, well, you did in the written examination. In the interview, very few people could cross the hurdle. So I think the first 30 years are like 6 or 7 Indians who made it. And every one of them was either given completely insignificant postings, really, really trivial postings in rural districts, or were treated so badly that they either left the service, like Surendranath Banerjee resigned, or they committed suicide. The case of a man called Chetty, who was British educated, went to school and Oxford University, came back in the civil service thinking he was going to be part of the glory of the empire, and he was treated so humiliatingly. All the real decisions were being made in the clubs, but he was excluded from the clubs because he was not white. And the poor man shot himself. However, when independence came, we chose to retain it. Why? We had just gone through the trauma of partition, these centuries of divide and rule by the British. We had seen the country fragmented, the flames of partition, the violence, the murder, the killings that accompanied it, searing the land. Was that a time to dismantle the administrative apparatus? So Sardar Patel, who the man who created India's unity, and Jawaharlal Nehru and others talked about this. Nehru actually was very anti-ICS. He wanted to disband it. But Patel Sahab said, listen, this has been the steel frame of the British Raj. Do we not need a steel frame to keep the Indian Union together at this time? And Nehruji and others agreed. Patel Sahab was right. Sardar Patel was right. So he converted the Indian Civil Service into the Indian Administrative Service with, unfortunately, much of the same roles, the same kind of attitude to power, the same kind of training as late as the 1960s. If you joined the IAS, you had to learn horse riding. And when asked why, our then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi herself said, a man who can control a horse can control a mob. That was still the attitude. So these Indians came to the administrative service. The accent changed, but the attitude did not change, and the arrogance in many cases did not change.
Now, talking of outdated laws, Shashi, pre-colonial India, it always had space for queer identities. You can talk about the Hijra community in the royal courts or queer figures.
In the Mahabharata.
Correct. And also, you know, queer figures in texts like in the Kama Sutra, for example.
Absolutely.
Now,
even the very notion of Ardha Narishwara, that is a divine figure who is half man, half woman, is part of our Hindu understanding of the divine.
So it was no big deal until the British came and imposed Section 377. That. Why did it take India some 70 odd years to undo it?
Because, again, that insidious habit of colonial entrenchment into the minds, assumptions and habits of our country. Our morality changed. I mean, I have to tell you that in the old days, till maybe up till about 1,000 years ago, we were a very permissive society. Today, Indians would be horrified if you read Al-Biruni, the traveler, who came from the Middle East, where Islamic societies are much more conservative. He was shocked by what he saw as the promiscuity of Indian women, for example. There were much more sexual freedoms. So first, the encounter with Islam created a certain moral protection. The entire habit, for example, of Rajasthani women covering their heads with a ghungat is not a pre-Islamic practice. The desire for women folk to be shielded was a result of that historical experience. Now, on top of this, you have an overlay of Victorian morality, which was both deeply censorious and deeply hypocritical. And that came in, and don't forget the Victorian Penal Code was imposed upon us. It was drafted by Macaulay in the 1830s, finally implemented in 1861. And that was at the peak of the Victorian era. And that is what outlawed, for example, criminal acts, what is it, carnal acts against the order of nature. Now, these people knew what the order of nature was. It's not natural for some people to have certain other proclivities from the rest of us. Who told them that? Victorian morality. Now, when these things then became part of the law, when you were punished for doing things that you felt were natural for you to do, then you yourself became ashamed. Think of the number of gay people and queer people who have had to commit suicide in our country over the last century or so because they felt so ashamed themselves of who they were. Now, these are inhumane things, and the very country that imposed these laws on us, the British, decriminalized all of this by the 1960s and 70s. We, however, the big old lumbering elephant, took much longer. And when I tried to bring a bill saying this is ridiculous, it was the ruling party's MPs that shouted me down, not once but twice.
Now, we say that the British left, but did they really? English state. Parents, they're teaching their children the English language even before they teach them their mother tongue. States are fighting about Hindi, but never English. Shashi, are we actually raising another colonized generation?
No, we're raising a more globalized generation. Look, I'll tell you, today there are more people who speak English in India, more Indians who speak English in India than there were when the British left. Right? And it's not just because there are more Indians altogether. It's because people have seen the advantages of English, and the modern late 20th and early 21st century economy is a globalized economy. It's an economy where people undoubtedly have advantages in speaking in English. Why? Let's say I am somebody sitting in Kerala and I'm going to sell you something in Delhi. What language do I speak to you? If I don't know Hindi and you don't know Malayalam, can I persuade you to buy my item? English is useful. The same logic now applies to my customer sitting in Germany. I don't know German. He doesn't know Hindi. But we both have a second language called English. We talk, we do. In this incredibly globalized world, English is an advantage. And people who have that advantage, they will get more access to jobs.
Shashi, the internet has reacted, and I'd love for you to react as well. When the Queen showed up here, she went for Kamal Hassan's movie about a freedom fighter fighting the British. Prince Charles also inaugurated a movie called Mangal Pandey, that blockbuster Bollywood movie. Now, the crowd...
What about Lagan?
Lagan, as well.
Well, beat the British at cricket.
The crowd clapping for the rebels. Yeah. How do you see it?
No, I think this is all part of coming to terms with the fact that they are no longer top dogs, and that, you know, there's an old African proverb that that as long as the lion doesn't have a voice, the tail of the hunt will always be that of the hunter. Now the lion has found its voice. So we're making our own stories. And we have a chance now to tell stories from our point of view. The success of RRR at the Oscars, the success of Lagan, which became a shortlisted movie for Best Film. This is all a way of actually opening the eyes of the world to the fact that there is another way of looking at these stories. If you look at the Hollywood and British depictions of colonialism in the films from, say, the 1920s to well into the end of the 20th century, it's entirely glorifying empire. It's depicting their rule as benevolent, as kind, and of course in conflict they always win. I remember watching a film called Ganga Din and wondering why the bad guys won in the end. I was rooting for the Indians to win this battle. But no, the bad guys won. And of course, poor Ganga Din as a water carrier went and helped the British rather than his own people. That era is now over. Even if a British person makes a film today about colonial India, he would have to show some sensitivity to the fact that there is an Indian point of view. It's very striking that this very remarkable, not always historically accurate, but still remarkable film on Mahatma Gandhi was made by a British director, Richard Attenborough. So he comes in the 1980s, less than 40 years after independence, and he realizes the story to be told is one that doesn't flatter his own people, but he makes it well.
I don't know if you've seen this reel doing the rounds. There was this Dhoom Machale song, a blockbuster Bollywood song.
Played on bagpipes.
And bagpipers and King Charles and Queen Kamala there. How do you react?
Oh, I loved it. But don't forget that in India, we've been doing this. What is fascinating is the British left in 1947. We still have bagpipers in the Indian Army. This is not a native instrument, right? This is an instrument left to us by the Scots, for God's sake. The truth is that we embrace, we take, we absorb, and we make it uniquely Indian.
Hopefully, the hangover, as you said, slowly and gradually will fade away. Thank you very much for speaking to us.
Great talking to you.
The colonial hangover lingers in our laws, language, and mindset. Breaking free means facing uncomfortable truths and rewriting the code imposed upon us. System may hang, but it can be rebooted.